This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
O heavenly grid, help us bear up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking. Here in this shell, we call life.
Our opening prayer, O Heavenly Grid, was from the Firesign Theater. It is dedicated to the late and deceased COP27 climate conference held in Egypt this month. Meanwhile, Katrin Ganzfindt from the German Enviro Group Ergewald reports oil, gas, and coal companies have announced the end of the future. They have big expansion plans. From Massachusetts, expert glaciologist Julie Brigham Grett reports ice collapse in the latest Cryosphere 2022 report. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
COP27.
The reviews are in.
In the UK, longtime Guardian columnist, author, and activist tweeted, "There was no progress on stopping climate breakdown. COP27 is another terrible failure." Bill McGuire is Professor Emeritus of Geophysical and Climate Hazards from the University of College London. His headline in The Guardian, "The Big Takeaway from COP27? These climate conferences just aren't working." End quote. It's hard to argue with that, Bill. He's been on Radio EcoShock, by the way, and he writes, "No seasoned observers are of the opinion that the world is any nearer tackling the climate emergency. Indeed, the real legacy of COP27 could well be exposing the climate summit for what it has become, a bloated traveling circus that sets up once a year and from which little but words ever emerge. It really does beggar belief," Bill says, "that in the course of 27 COPs, there has never been a formal agreement to reduce the world's fossil fuel use." End quote from Bill McGuire. One of the world's leading climate scientists says, "Don't panic yet." From Penn State, this inventor of the famous hockey stick graph of climbing temperatures, Michael Mann says, "Don't despair. It's never about a single COP. Yes, this year's summit, like every summit, fell short of what is needed, but the overall trajectory is progress. This is not the time to give up on the world's only functional framework to tackle climate change." That's a quote from Michael Mann. Famous author and lefty activist Naomi Klein says the COP system is not working. Jake Johnson covered Klein's reaction for Common Dreams. "Let's try something new." Naomi Klein calls for boycott of next COP climate summit. He quotes Klein saying, "Now is the time to decide not to do this all over again next year, when the summit will be in the UAE. Yes, the site of next year's climate conference of the parties is in the super oil and gas producing Gulf state, the United Arab Emirates. That sounds like a great place for activism and input from NGOs or even those pesky scientists, except it will be another playground for fossil fuel lobbyists." Why are the world climate summits failing now 27 times? We could circle back to George Monbiot with his key idea, the pollution paradox.
The pollution paradox. The more damaging the commercial enterprise, the more money it must spend on politics to ensure it is not regulated out of existence. As a result, politics comes to be dominated by the most harmful commercial enterprises.
George continues, "Global negotiations are a charade. The rich world governments meeting in Egypt at the moment have no intention of taking the required action to address the climate crisis, paying the money they've promised poor nations, or doing anything other than what the corporate lobbyists demand. They would rather see the end of the habitable planet than upset their sponsors," says George Monbiot. One of the greatest geniuses of all time, Dr. Albert Einstein, said, "Insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results." I am with Naomi on this one. The process is not working. In fact, the COP system is built to fail. Every citizen and group and government who actually want climate action have to get organizing and start the real climate summit. In fact, we need far more than a summit once a year on this countdown to climate hell. The world needs to fund and establish an emergency headquarters, built on a distributed network from every quarter of civilization. This institution would have scientists, lawyers, economists, politicians, investigators, and activists working full-time every hour to change us away from emissions, to end the fossil fuels, and to get more climate-friendly agriculture. Damaging the climate is a crime, not a plan for profit. Our next guest says climate wrecking is the plan. The most profitable companies in the world have already announced your future forecast. It is a greenhouse world where weather extremes and mass casualties are normal. Yes, oil, gas, and coal multinationals plan to expand until we reach a hellscape way over 2 degrees hotter. They are telling us right out loud. A group of nonprofits are listening and taking notes. A global database led by the German environment group Urgewald began tracking world coal projects, but now we also have Google, the global oil and gas exit list. It tracks 900 companies responsible for 95% of oil and gas production. Our guest, Katrin Ganswit, is an energy finance researcher for Urgewald from Germany. Katrin Ganswit, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. Well, everybody loves a hidden conspiracy, but are the intentions of fossil fuel companies a secret?
No, I don't think they're a secret. They're in every annual report of every company you want to have a look at, basically. But what is maybe sometimes hard to see is the big picture. So what we're trying to do is really look at the full fossil fuel industry. As you said, we looked at the coal industry since 2017, and since last year we also compile the global oil and gas exit list. So like this, you have it in one database, all the actual production and actual plans of the oil and gas industry.
So just to be clear, you have a coal project, you have the gas and oil exit list, and then you just recently released a report before COP27. Tell us about that.
Yes, so because the COP is in the African continent and because the interest in fossil fuels from Africa never stopped and is even rising since we have the energy crisis in Europe around the Ukraine-Russia war, we had to look at Africa in general as a whole. And we used our research from our global oil and gas exit list and from our global coal exit list and extended it a bit even. And we had a look at all the companies who are expanding fossil fuel usage or fossil fuel resources on the African continent. We released a report during COP on November the 14th at a press conference there to tell directly to people who were at COP interested in the subject or also the ones who didn't want to hear it about how there's still colonization in Africa through energy exploitation.
Right. So that's the report. Who is financing fossil fuel expansion in Africa? It's available free from Urgewald and other sites. So France's company, the Total Energies, they're planning, investing, and building a lot of new fossil fuels in Africa. And as you say, it sounds a little like energy colonization. Is that what you see happening? And is this are these new wells and all the projects really going to help Africans who need it the most?
Our report was supported by 36 African NGOs, and the term colonization, actually the term of we are the global north is using Africa as a petrol station, came from them. It was said also by Omar Amavi, who was at our press conference, who's leading the Stop EACOP campaign. And they were clear, our partners also, when we talked to them before we wanted to compile the report, and they state that also in the intro of the report, that fossil fuel resources who are now newly developed in Africa are mainly for the use of the global north. We can see that in different parts. We can see that just less than a third of the companies who are looking for new oil and gas resources in Africa are from African countries. Over 60% of the companies who are now developing new oil and gas resources are from outside of Africa. 90% of the new LNG capacity built in Africa is for export. Over 50% of the pipelines built in Africa are for export to Europe. So it's not there as a this expansion of fossil fuels is not there to support the African continent, but to support the European or Asian countries who want to use the resources And in Africa itself, many groups are demanding a change to full renewable energy on the African continent. They're stating again and again that this continent contributed the least to climate change, but still has 40% of the renewable potential of the globe. And what we can show also with our data is that there are several LNG terminals, for example, planned on the continent, which cost about $30 billion. And at the same time, the International Energy Agency says $25 billion are necessary per year to make Africa renewable until 2030. So our report shows very clearly money and investments have to go into a totally different direction than they do now.
Going to the global look in the global oil and gas exit list, we find huge expansion plans leading to something called, quote, an IEA NZE overshoot. What is that?
Yes, our IEA net zero overshoot scenario is based on the net zero by 2050 report, the roadmap the IEA laid out last year, which should limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. The IEA is a very conservative organization. Nevertheless, banks, financial institutions, industry likes to listen to the IEA, and they really have come a long way that we can, even if their data is very, or their projections are very, over-optimistic, we still use it to show, basically to translate what we see in our lists, what that means according to the IEA net zero scenario. So we are looking at how many new oil and gas resources are currently developed and how many of them have been under development before January 2021, because everything which is under development since then is not in line according to the IEA net zero 2050 scenario. So they have, these companies have an overshoot. So we can very clearly, for example, say there are the top six companies with the highest IEA net zero overshoot. Three of them are majors, Exxon, Total, and Chevron, and then there are three national companies, Saudi Aramco, Qatar Energy, and ENOC.
You know, it's interesting. Most of the climate campaigns that I'm familiar with target the Western multinationals like ExxonMobil or Chevron, but it seems like we just don't know enough, and maybe we're a little afraid, to tackle the Middle East countries like Saudi Aramco and Qatar Energy and the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. I wonder, are these major climate killers, who are planning on expanding the most, by the way, are they getting a pass from environmental activists and from governments?
I wouldn't say so, but obviously, it's very obvious that the more pressure you can do in societies where it's possible to speak, at least to a certain average of freeness, yeah, or where media can say what they want. So that's the one point. And the other question is, of course, who does a company get money from? So the more a company is nationalized and also gets national and public funds, the harder it is, of course, to campaign on that on a global scale. We were looking mainly at private financial institutions, so also our campaigning goes more like to the private capital, which is campaignable, so to say. So I wouldn't say there's a free pass, but on the one hand, it's a question of opportunity, and then there's, of course, the question of, like, just because there are other companies we maybe cannot tackle, which are maybe as bad as the ones in our own countries or in our whole region, it doesn't mean we don't still have the historical duty to campaign against those which are in front of our nose, so to say.
Well, Katrin, you live in Germany, a European country scrambling to find more fossil fuels after the failure of Russian supplies. Consumers all over the world demand their gas tanks be filled, their homes be heated, all the consumer goodies have to keep coming. Can we blame Middle Eastern monarchs for giving us what we want?
Not as long as we pay for it. I mean, here in the German radio news, you hear more about how people are angry about soccer games in Qatar than they were about our chancellor and our head energy company in Germany going to Qatar asking for gas. So this doesn't add up. So in the end, it's the question, if we want to see leadership on how to do renewable energy transition and go away from fossil fuels, we have to do that in front of our doorstep first before we demand that only from others. It has to be both ways, always.
So Google, as we'll call it, reports 96% of upstream companies have expansion plans. What is an upstream business, and what does that say about the energy transition?
Upstream means basically the production of oil and gas. So production with conventional but also unconventional methods like fracking, tar sands, ultra-deep water drilling. And it says basically that the oil and gas producers don't have any plans to change their business model and that none of them have a credible transition plan. If these companies would really want to transition, they should first stop to expand their operations. The old business model is you show how many reserves you develop, and according to that, you are rated. According to that, your share price is connected. So they didn't change any of that. They didn't understand yet. Either they didn't yet understand climate change or they don't care about it. And, I mean, we have seen that there were reports on growing numbers of fossil fuel lobbyists at each COP, basically, and we still don't see fossil fuels in the COP text as demanded, and it's phase down or phase out.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Katrin Gansfit, an energy researcher for the environment group Ergovald. Your specialty is coal. Our recent guest, Patrick Bond, told us Germany is searching for more coal, including a visit this year by German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, trying to find more coal. We thought Germany was getting out of that dirty power source. What's going on?
We're going out of the dirty power source, but first of all, the nitty-gritty details of the plan can change. But the other part of it is, of course, as long as coal plants are still running, you still need new coal to fuel it. The big problem of the fossil fuel resources are they're not abundant like wind and energy, but you still have to dig them up. And that's basically what is still happening in Germany. And there is big discussion, of course, on how much coal is actually really needed and if all the coal which is digged out shouldn't be left in the ground because we should stop using coal much earlier than 2030. But this is why we're still looking for new coal, because we still burn it.
Makes sense. Okay, so now Patrick Bond also spoke of gaping holes and illusions in the project to transition the South African coal mining industry into renewables. What have you heard about how that project is going?
Yeah, the South African coal industry, it's also twofold. You have, on the one hand, of course, the country being dependent, about 80% on coal energy, and about a third of the coal which is produced in South Africa is also exported to Asia, but of course also to Europe, and even more so now since we don't have or don't want to use Russian supplies anymore in Germany. And what we see there, what we hear from our partners in South Africa is that a big problem is, of course, the Eskom, the national utility Eskom, they have a really bad track record on maintenance on the huge new coal projects, and still there's regular load shedding for several hours for South African people. There's a lot of loss in transport of energy. It's a lot of energy is used for the industry, and actually the real energy transition, it cannot happen in South Africa as long as a clear phase out for coal isn't announced, and as long as also the energy ministry is still pursuing for the use of other fossil fuels as a transition, like gas, a so-called transition.
Before the COP, Ergovald, along with Stand.Earth and 40 partner NGOs, released the 2022 update for the Global Coal Exit List. First, please explain what an exit list is, and then how it can be used by researchers or campaigners.
Our global coal exit list should show the full coal industry. It was made because we saw that financial institutions are not aware of what a coal company is, even if they claim to want to divest from coal. On the other hand, it was also possible with such a list to check portfolios, for example, of your pension fund, or to do research on the real investments and financing of banks, and like that to support not only our own campaign, but also NGO campaigns. So we use the list. On the one hand, we distribute it to financial institutions to make good, impactful coal policies, and now with the goggle also oil and gas policies, and for our NGO colleagues to do impactful campaigns.
There has been a myth, even in environmental circles, that coal is winding down. It is a dirty sunset industry from a past century. It's headed for bankruptcy and shutdowns. And when you dig into 1,000 coal companies and their subsidiaries and their plans, is that what you find happening?
Also, what we see is that the expansion of the industry is slowing down, especially the power plant expansion, because as said, as long as you burn coal, you need mines, continuous coal supply. But we definitely see a winding down of the expansion in specific countries, and we see a beginning or already implemented coal phase-out in different European countries. We also see a winding down of coal in the U.S. We, of course, see on the other side the rise of LNG, of fracking in the U.S. Yeah, so you always have to look at that as a whole, yeah, on the whole fossil fuel industry, especially if you look at coal, you always have to ask if a company wants to phase out coal, is it replaced with gas or a country? This is also a question we actually had very early since we produce and distribute the global coal exit list, discussions with NGOs, but also with financial institutions are always, okay, what's next? What's coming after coal, basically, as the subject of gas and not just mining out coal, but actually not replacing it with gas, is it there? And obviously you have differences when you look at the whole globe. As we know, there's still a lot of expansion plans, for example, in China, and in general, the most energy growth, of course, is in Asia.
Indonesia is right now building a huge coal plant as we speak, and of course they're a major miner and exporter of coal, so they haven't stopped. At the recent Egyptian COP, India called for a different language about coal. They continued to argue India should be allotted enough energy to develop, as Western countries did. But then they add this wrinkle. Why should developed countries discriminate against coal? I mean, Europe and America want to keep their gas. They call this methane fuel natural. Some even want to label it green. But India has to give up its staple energy source, which happens to be coal, they say. What do you think?
Yeah, in a way, of course, he's right. I mean, this is also the question on who you point that comment towards. Because, of course, if you look at the country on the government level, that's exactly the point. As long as developed nations who have a historical duty to reduce CO2 emissions faster, as long as they're still labeling gas green, I don't wonder people in China and India say, as long as Germany still burns coal, as long as everyone's still labeling gas green, we're going to keep our coal, or we make clean coal plants. Yeah, of course, that is the answer. I don't wonder, maybe if I can, one note on Indonesia, because you're right, and the big specialty is on Indonesia, of course, that it's a big exporter, so its economy is depending on the export and not only the energy system, also to a much larger extent than, for example, South Africa.
Well, none of this dangerous coal development happens without big money behind it. You report Royal Bank of Canada, Citibank, and major public pensions continue to bankroll coal. Is there a growing list of large-scale institutions who have sworn off coal investing?
Yeah, there is. The question is rather like, it's not in all financial centers of the world, unfortunately. So we see, especially on coal, a big development in Europe. We see rather smaller steps in the U.S. still, especially when it comes on company exclusion level, and also only at first financial institutions in different Asian places like Malaysia or Singapore or the Philippines, where you see actually movement. So the biggest movement is still in Europe, and we do not see, for example, that especially when it comes to oil and gas, there is like the big front runners already. But in the coal area, we definitely can see that.
But the top four coal plant developers are all Chinese companies. Talk to us about coal in China.
In China, the coal industry is still growing. That is to say about China, it's hard to do or to change what's happening inside China from outside. What was successful was campaigns or whatever internal lobbying in China also happened on new coal plants or new coal projects outside of China. So we could see several projects which have been stopped or delayed, where, for example, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China stepped out in Africa, for example, in Kenya or in Zambia. So we saw a success there. Inside China, and of course also the financing of Chinese coal companies can happen almost exclusively through China. Nevertheless, we do see especially investments also in Chinese coal companies that have special financial subsidiaries. Through them, they can also derive money on other stock markets. So there is still financial flows to Chinese coal from the global north.
And when a coal power plant is built, the expectation is it will operate for about 60 years. All the new coal plants built in the next few years would be spewing carbon and pollution until 2080. At the same time, we've already crossed these irreversible climate tipping points. What really needs to happen in the coal industry?
It has to stop operating as soon as possible. I would say in Europe now, but we said that 5 years ago, we said that 10 years ago, I think already. And I think the more we see that it's hard or that there is resistance in the global south to change their track, or in countries like India and China, however you want to classify them, on that track, it actually means in the global north we have to try harder. As said, we have this global responsibility of being historical, the biggest emitters, and that's why we also have to be the front runners by far on phasing out all fossil fuels, and at the beginning, or at the worst, obviously coal. And then we can at the same time demand the same from other nations.
Can civilization really survive without coal? Wouldn't a lot of people die without it?
Interesting question. I think I haven't been asked that so far. So far, I've been asked only by, let's say, conservative financial institutions if it wouldn't be bad for development and people would lose their jobs. In fact, it's no secret that coal mining as well as coal combustion has severe health risks for the local population. Because you talked about Africa before, I know from my own experience that in the mining regions in South Africa, the local population, the kids who grow up there, usually their lungs are so bad they can't even work in the mines. So coal kills, as the campaign Life After Coal in South Africa says, and obviously not using coal would be much better for the local health. And as well, it's no secret that the use of renewable energies and the maintenance in the renewable sector can also create a lot of jobs. The question is just how early does a country start to transition? Does a country start to transition early enough so they're not trapped in the fossil fuel trap forever?
So we've got men, mostly men, in suits proposing great big projects in corporate boardrooms around the world. And your group and your fellow colleagues help to figure out what the total is. But do we think that national leaders in Riyadh and Paris and Washington and Beijing have added it up? Do they know what is being developed here, and yet they still issue all the permits and the subsidies and the guarantees to make it happen?
Of course, I can just guess what they really know and think. The biggest share of humanity is very clear about climate change and also very clear about where it comes from. But there is lots of ways to try to steer towards wrong solutions, or of putting all money into solutions which are not the obvious and clear one. And I think people know that, and either they believe they can just still make a dime just before this world goes down, or maybe gone to Mars before it's getting bad, or they overestimate the little time we have to make a change.
I'm afraid all of that is true. So, Catherine, when you go home at night with all these figures in your head, do you think there is a way out of this mess?
Honestly, I don't know. I hope so. And I also have a little kid, and I wouldn't want to tell her I didn't try.
Absolutely. And I say the same to my own grandson. Could you please tell our listeners where they can find this useful information about the fossil fuel industry and their expansion plans?
So all our data is explained, accessible, researchable online. We have on coalexit.org, the Global Coal exit list. You can also see our financial research on the whole global coal industry and look for a bank of your choice or investor of your choice. And we also have on Google.org, like, don't confuse it with Google, it's just the acronym of Global Oil and Gas Exit List. And also here you can find, first of all, also lots of background stories on different projects, connections to other NGOs who are working on this reputational risk projects on the ground, and you can download the Excel file. In both cases, we ask for free login to just count how many people are using it. Does it make sense? Is it interesting? Does it make sense to do it again? So please log in and download our lists and have a look, and you find contacts there where you can ask us all kinds of questions on that.
I will put links to the Global Oil and Gas Exit List and CoalExit.org and a lot more in my show blog at Ecoshock.org. Catherine, thank you for speaking with our listeners.
Thanks for the interview.
We've been speaking with respected German environment group Urgewald and the leading energy researcher there, Catherine Ganswit.
You're listening to Ecoshock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Ecoshock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio Ecoshock with your host, Alex Smith.
In November, Hurricane Nicole swept away foundations along the Florida coast. The nightly news flashed images of homes and apartment buildings fallen into the sea or tottering dangerously at the edge. This is a glimpse into the future as ice disappears from the poles. To get a global picture of the changing ice world, a network of scientists formed the International Cryosphere Initiative. Their State of the Cryosphere 2022 report finds sea ice and glaciers from the poles to the Himalayas are endangered species. We reached Julia Brigham Grett, a scientist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-author of the new report. Julie is an authority on glacial geology and their history and past climates. From Massachusetts, Julie Brigham Grett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
From research vessels to camps on the ice, you have seen what we have not. What is it like to be a human in the presence of vast ice more than a mile deep?
It's an awesome experience because of the power that you feel when the ice calves from the front in a tidewater glacier, when that ice falls off and that booming sound happens. It's just an awesome feeling of the power of that ice. And also, as a geologist, seeing the erosion and the capacity of these ice sheets to change our planet, that's an awesome feeling that I get when I'm near a glacier.
Well, just to be clear, what is the cryosphere? Is it just ice at the poles?
No, actually, the cryosphere is a term that refers to everything that's frozen in the sense of, we think of glaciers and ice sheets first, but it also includes the sea ice in the polar regions, the seasonal changes in sea ice. It also includes the permafrost, the frozen ground that's year after year stays below freezing. Across large swaths of the Arctic. And we also include in the cryosphere the mountain glaciers, the small ice sheets and small glaciers in like the Andes and the Himalayas and even in the Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. These are essentially water towers for the planet that feed water supplies to the people who live in those regions. So the cryosphere includes all of those things. And the other thing that we've also included in our report is the effect of ocean acidification in the polar regions, and that is the change in pH in the ocean caused by CO2 in the atmosphere.
What has that got to do with the ice, though?
Well, so as the CO2 in the atmosphere is currently increasing 10 times than anything we've seen in 50 million years, literally, we're seeing this rapid rise in CO2 caused by humans, and that CO2 gets absorbed into the surface ocean. And so it lowers the pH, and it makes it much more difficult for calcium organisms to calcify their shells. So the base of the food chain in a lot of the surface oceans of the polar regions are based on these small organisms, and many of them are having trouble making their shells and surviving, and it takes a long time for that to recover. So we include that as part of our concerns about the polar regions. You know, anyone that's opened a bottle of champagne or even a soda of some sort knows that carbon dioxide will stay more dissolved in cold water than it does in warm water. So just try opening a warm bottle of champagne sometime and you'll know what I mean. So in the polar regions, that cold water has the capacity to take up even more CO2. And so we're seeing an increase in calcium carbonate. So it doesn't really have much to do with glaciers, and it's not exactly my field of study, but it is a concern because it goes in parallel with what's happening to the glaciers and ice sheets, to the cryosphere, with our increasing fossil fuel use.
I began talking about wrecked coastlines. Do you think melting ice at both poles is already contributing to wrecked coastlines?
Absolutely. It's a crisis that's being felt in many parts of the world. I've been working with indigenous people living along the southwest coast of Alaska. Some people refer to this area, it's the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. It's a large, flat landscape that is sinking naturally because it's a delta, so it's receiving weight from the Yukon River, from the sediments. But also sea level is rising there, and there's tremendous coastal erosion there because it's permafrost, frozen ground at the coast. It's also being thermally eroded. So this is, in many ways, ground zero for Alaska. Oddly enough, a state that, of course, extracts a lot of fossil fuels. But sea level is rising all over. For example, forecasts are for the Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida coastline, there could be as many as 6 to 10 million people that need to move in the coming decades. And this is schools, factories, cities, and no one's talking about this enough. So in our own country and across the world, sea level is rising, and unfortunately, it's not reversible. You know, sea level rise is essentially forever on human timescales.
You talked about the thrill, if I could say it that way, of seeing these glaciers calve away, and I know that 10 or 15 years ago, reading reports from glaciologists, it seemed like that was the main concern of how water was going to reach the oceans. But now a recent study from Antarctica discovers a deep river running from lakes below the glaciers to the Southern Ocean. Is it possible there's a massive underground of meltwater in both Antarctica and Greenland that we don't know a lot about yet? And if so, what would that mean for sea level rise?
Well, exactly. One thing we have learned from both Greenland and parts of Antarctica are there are subglacial lakes in many places that we didn't realize. And now that we know that they're there, scientists are discovering even more of them as the geophysics improves. And we're now capable to actually see these lakes communicate to one another. So you can actually, there are scientists who can actually see the surface of the ice sheet slightly go up and down as these water bodies underneath drain from one lake to another. And the problem with that much water at the base of the glaciers, at the base of the ice sheets, is that, of course, they're not in contact with the bed, so they're not, there's a loss of friction. Just like hydroplaning with your car on a wet, rainy day, you lose contact and lose friction, and this will cause the glaciers to slide even faster. And we have to go back to when Canada and North America were covered with large ice sheets. We find evidence that this happened in these earlier glaciations as well. We can learn by looking at past ice sheets about what we might think about the behavior of the ice sheets we have left on the planet. So it is a serious concern, and we now know there's a lot more water at the bottom of these glaciers than we thought before.
Well, let's look at the new report. The State of the Cryosphere report summarizes the main threats with four different futures, depending on our emissions, of course. And the first is very low to low emissions, and it sounds like something we could have hoped for 20 years ago. But for me, that's in the rearview mirror. Not everyone agrees with that. What do you think? Should we really be counting on these low to very low emission scenarios?
Well, we have to remain hopeful to slow down the warming of the planet. And I have to say, I agree with you. I think overshoot, going beyond 1.5 degrees, we're already at 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial for the planet. So dropping our emissions to keep the planet below 1.5 does seem like a long shot, a real long shot. But the truth is, the other scenarios, particularly if we go over 2 to 3 degrees, there's some really critical tipping points with the glaciers and ice sheets that could be surpassed, particularly if we go beyond 2 and to 3 degrees. And let me give you an example. I've studied across the Arctic a time period about 3 million years ago, which really isn't that long ago, but 3 million years ago when there was no Greenland ice sheet, there was no sea ice in the Arctic, and we had forested conditions all across Arctic Canada. In fact, even Hudson's Bay hadn't formed yet. And at that time, the temperature of the planet was about 3 degrees above pre-industrial. Only 3 degrees. And we think that the CO2 in the atmosphere at that time was around 400 ppm. So we are already driving the planet toward an environment of what the Earth looked like 3 million years ago with no Greenland ice sheet and probably no West Antarctic ice sheet. And as far as scientists around the world, from the Mediterranean to Australia, New Zealand, and even Alaska, sea level, we think, was around 16 to 23 meters above present at that time. So we're driving the planet, even at 3 degrees, we're driving the planet toward massive sea level rise over the coming centuries. So, you know, the predictions right now are at least probably 1 meter by the time today's first graders are in their 80s. You know, so a meter of sea level rise, if you just look at a place like Florida, is pretty devastating. I think overshoot is likely. We're going to have to get involved with pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and, you know, all hands on deck approach to decreasing CO2.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is expert glaciologist Professor Julie Brigham Grett from the University of Massachusetts, and we're talking about the new 2022 report on world ice. Let's talk about sea ice. In 2007, even scientists were shocked when the Arctic sea ice shrank way back. 2012 was even worse. What is the current state of Arctic sea ice?
Not a happy one, for sure. What scientists who model the Arctic sea ice are seeing, of course, a dramatic shift toward a more open, ice-free Arctic. And we've lost nearly most of the multi-year ice, the ice that's quite several meters thick that persists year after year. There's very little multi-year ice left in the Arctic. And I speak from experience in that when I was first doing fieldwork in 1980 in Arctic Alaska, I got stuck in the sea ice, even in August. But now there's largely open water across the coast of Alaska and certainly parts of Arctic Canada in places where it used to be frozen all the time. And unfortunately and symbolically, about a week ago or a while ago here at the COP in Egypt, a symbolically tipped over a large, what we call a Toblerone, it was like a pillar that had Arctic sea ice written on the side of it, and they toppled it over because we have crossed a tipping point with Arctic sea ice. Even if we drop all the CO2 in the atmosphere and the methane in the atmosphere tomorrow, it's very likely we're still going to see an ice-free Arctic in the coming decades. And in literally 10 to 20, 30 years, the Arctic will be ice-free. So we've kind of missed that tipping point. We're beyond that now, and this is what we worry is we cannot miss other tipping points. So we can slow it down, and Arctic sea ice is something we can bring back if we can cool the planet and lower CO2. So in contrast to sea level, Arctic sea ice is something we could bring back eventually, in the summer sea ice I'm talking about.
Well, scientists on the show have warned an Arctic without sea ice in the summer, the so-called Blue Ocean event, would make changes all over the world. And I noticed that in your report, You even mentioned that sea ice levels can affect faraway lands like Tibet. How is that possible?
Well, an open Arctic Ocean really starts to change. It's absorbing more heat, and of course, it has downstream effects that it can affect the polar front, the way the westerlies are traveling, the waviness of the polar front, and therefore have downstream effects throughout the climate system. And I think that the adage that, you know, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic is really true, is that the Arctic system and the is linked to the global atmospheric system, just like our oceans are. And so we have to expect that there will be effects in other places. I think most people are familiar with the fact that when we have an El Nino event in the South Pacific, it's a warming of the surface oceans. And even though it's so far away in the South Pacific, it has impacts all over the world, causing droughts in Africa, for example. So I think we really need to hopefully raise awareness that the Earth is a complete complex system. So what happens in one place can affect other places, downflow, down ice, and downwind.
Is there other new science that you would like to tell us about in our understanding of ice and climate change at the poles?
I think what's surprising everyone, and you've already hinted about this, is the rate at which things are happening. And I think one of the maybe more frightening revelations that's really emerging now is the amount of CO2 and methane coming from permafrost, from frozen ground as it starts to thaw across large parts of the Arctic. And here again, that flux of even more CO2 and methane into the atmosphere, it means that countries around the world have to even increase their ambition to decrease CO2 to compensate for what now looks like a natural emission due to the warming of the high latitudes. So one thing that's been happening is we're talking about the whole region of permafrost as a country in and of itself. It's already has more emissions coming from permafrost than from the country of Japan, industrialized country of Japan. So the country of permafrost is really a new revelation that we're really trying to grapple with, because again, it's going to take all, we have to cool the planet as fast as we can in order to slow down the emissions from the permafrost. I would say that would be my number one pick for large surprises.
In the English language expression, anything glacial means something moving so slow that we don't really see it. And at the 2012 AAAS conference, the presentations by glaciologists were sparsely attended. I was the only reporter in the room. Now the alarming state of the ice is reaching the front page. When you began your career, did you ever think you would see so much change in your lifetime?
Not at all. In fact, when I was in graduate school, so let's go back 40 years, I was taught that the Greenland ice sheet and Antarctica were stable, and they have been stable for 5,000 years, and that we weren't worried about that. So we were going about our research, studying the past history without so much concern about the future. And here we are so many years later, and we're in the face of really rapid change. In fact, let me mention that we're now going into Antarctic summer, okay, in the Southern Hemisphere. Over this past few months, there hasn't been much sea ice around McMurdo Station in Antarctica. That's just shocking, because 25 years ago, I was on a National Academy study about how we need to build more icebreakers to get fuel into McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Now there's no sea ice. And so that, in just 25 years, to see an area around Antarctica go from heavy, thick sea ice to not having much at all is just shocking. And I also, as I mentioned earlier, reminisce back to the times when I was working along the Arctic coast and constantly had to deal with sea ice. I could go there today and not have any problems with sea ice at all, because it's retreated so far back to the north in the summer. So this is happening fast within even my own career. So I can't be more shocked than anyone, because I've seen it myself. And if you just speak to the indigenous people living in the Arctic, they will also share their story about this change.
Well, I'm thinking about how we're going to get this word out. And last year, Argentina's parliament passed the National Law of Comprehensive Environmental Education. So the environment will be taught to students of all ages there. Can we teach kids how the cryosphere works, and should we?
Absolutely. We need to teach them about the cryosphere, about the rate at which things are happening, and also provide hope and have them see a future in their contributions to decreasing CO2, to changing the way that we develop our energy, and also to help. I mean, we're going to need psychologists. We're going to need lawyers. We're going to need all kinds of people, not just scientists, to help the particularly coastal environments adapt. We're going to need new ways to grow food. Think about, instead of a couple of days above 100 degree Fahrenheit in the central part of the United States, we're going to have 3 months of over 100 degrees. Canada might end up growing a lot more food. I mean, we have all kinds of reasons to bring everyone to the table to work on a more sustainable future and to be optimistic that, yes, we have the tools to change. And people can be optimistic about contributing to that. So we need to keep our young people enthusiastic about their role in helping us reverse the damage that we've caused to the planet, and for them to see a future in that that's helpful and can help change the world. Because being pessimistic is just not going to be very, very hopeful. It's not being optimistic is going to be a bummer, and it just is not going to move us forward. So I believe in optimism and looking at ways for people all to contribute to making the world a better place.
I'm not sure I agree. I don't feel optimistic myself that we can avoid a catastrophic loss of this planetary cooling system. It seems like it's on its way out. It may take hundreds of years or a couple thousand years to really go, but it's just hard for me to build optimism about that. Where I have my optimism is that humans will somehow adapt, and so will the other animals and plants, and we will find a new but different world.
That's very possible, and I certainly would not disagree. But I do think that we all have a place where we can think about a more sustainable and resilient world to the changes that we face. And with that, there has to be hope and optimism.
As we wrap this up, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Other than I think it's really important for everyone to be aware, think about the global system, not just your own backyard, but think about what's happening to the planet as a whole and to people across the world. And I think we need to really increase our empathy for all of humanity and for all of living systems. And I really wish that global, act locally, think globally type of idea would really resonate around the world.
From the University of Massachusetts Amherst, we've been speaking with Professor Julie Brigham Grett. Julie is co-author of The State of the Cryosphere Report, 2022, Growing Losses, Global Impacts. That report is a free download from ICCINet.org. I will put a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Julie, thank you for your work and for talking with us today.
All right. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'd like to talk about a couple of new science questions from the Julie Brigham Grett interview. Julie tells us only 3 million years ago there was no Greenland ice and no sea ice. Forests grew right up to the shores of the Arctic Ocean. How hot was it? Just 3 degrees C hotter than Earth was a few hundred years ago in pre-industrial times. The United Nations reports we are on course for 2.9 degrees C by the end of this century, unless we slash emissions drastically. It gets hotter after that. But many scientists think that is too optimistic. On our current emissions track, setting a new record again last year, Earth might reach 3 degrees of warming before 2100. Greenland will not suddenly emerge bare in the next 80 years. Experts think that process, unstoppable once it starts, would take a few centuries at least, because it's over a mile deep ice that has to melt away. But the Arctic sea ice could be gone now and then, during this decade, and possibly forever in following decades. That changes how much solar energy is reflected back into space. It creates hotter oceans, more heating, and changes in ocean currents and weather as far away as Tibet. How could it do that? The exact mechanisms connecting the Arctic sea ice and Tibet are still a field of developing science. It is a case of teleconnection. Analysis, satellite and ground-based, clearly shows a relationship between specific sea ice patterns in the Arctic and the weather in Tibet. Here is a good paper on what we know. Effects of Arctic sea ice in autumn on extreme cold events over the Tibetan Plateau in the following winter. Possible mechanisms. That is an open access article. It's free to you, and it's published October 2021. Find links in my show blog. We also learn from Julie that the Arctic is a living biosphere. She mentions the Arctic is full of living things, and this is partly new science. As Damian Carrington wrote in The Guardian, November 17th, the scientists collected surface meltwaters from 8 glaciers across Europe and North America and from 2 sites on the Greenland ice cap. They found tens of thousands of microbes in each milliliter of water. That's astounding. There's a lot of life going on up there, and we haven't really counted that in when we do our climate science. But here's the sort of new question that I think came up during this interview. Will a hotter Arctic Ocean capture less carbon and thus lead to more heating for all of us? Julie Brigham Grett uses the analogy of a warm champagne bottle or soda. It doesn't hold much bubbly when it's too hot. And that's carbon dioxide, that bubbly. Colder liquids hold more CO2. Surely that implies, even if the Arctic Ocean warms just a little, due to the vast area, that could mean many tons less carbon dioxide sucked into the sea compared to pre-industrial times. Every time a sink like the ocean can hold less, more of the greenhouse gas pollution from our tailpipes and smokestacks stays in the atmosphere, and that means more warming. Scientists have definitely shown the Arctic Ocean is getting more acidic, and that's in the Cryosphere 2022 report. But as far as we know, there has not yet been a study into the impact of polar ocean warming and carbon dioxide capture. It would be interesting to quantify this and then try some projections for low, medium, and high emission scenarios. I think we could be missing yet another factor that will heat the world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.